This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome to the second hour of USA Today for Monday, May 20th, 2024. My name is Nancy Frank. I'm reading from the radio reading services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. We'll be reading the opinion and money sections of the USA Today for today. And starting with the opinion section, 49 years later, trauma lingers after our fraught escape from Vietnam. As part of Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, this is the story of how a South Vietnamese Air Force officer flew his family and two dozen other evacuees in a helicopter onto the USS Midway for their escape as they lost their country to Communist North Vietnam in 1975. Nguyen Van Dong, now 81, lives in Texas. This account was written by his daughter, Gan Nguyen, who lives with her husband and children in New York City. April 28, 1975. A heavy fist banged on our front door. My family lived near Can Tho Air Base in South Vietnam, which was used by the U.S. Air Force and the Republic of Vietnam Air Force during the war. My father, Nguyen Van Dong, was an Air Force major. At 3 years old, I hid behind his legs as he opened the door. An officer said the North Vietnamese Army was encroaching. He ordered us to evacuate immediately to Con San Island, along with 40 other families on the base. All able-bodied men, including my father, were instructed to stay behind to fight. My mother, Nguyen Thai Nhiem, packed frantically for what she thought would be a few days, taking only what she could carry on her shoulders. She would have my little brother strapped to her back, and my sister and me each clutching one of her hands. Despite the fact that the United States had already withdrawn its combat forces 2 years earlier, no one wanted to believe that South Vietnam faced an imminent demise, but no one could ignore the reality of the constant sirens and bombs. Mom, my siblings, and I arrived at Con San in the middle of the night on a Chinook helicopter. During the evacuation, Mom had been too distracted to notice the lump growing on the edge of my face, but now I was feverish, with mumps and a throat infection. Fortunately, a friend knew a doctor stationed at Con San Prison. He took us to his home, where he fed us, gave me medication, and urged us to sleep. Back at the Can Tho Air Base, all pilots were ordered to meet on Con San. That included my father, whose mission was to transport the women and children to somewhere safe. Dad's friends, who were on base duty, had to stay behind. Dad promised to take care of their families until they could reunite with them. Dad landed his Hue on Con San Island about 20 hours after he had arrived and leaped with joy when he saw us heading toward him. I can still remember the scent of him as he covered me in kisses. Together, we hurried to the beach where women and children were waiting and whispering about the impending collapse of Saigon, our nation's capital. Washington had withdrawn its diplomats, the death knell of South Vietnam. Dad knew that he and his cohorts could not defend a country with a trickle of bullets when the enemy had continued support from China and the Soviet Union. Evacuation onto the USS Midway. Con San became the central meeting point for evacuation of both military officials and civilians. At 7 a.m., Dad and his deputy pilot squeezed 31 passengers into a helicopter normally reserved for a dozen. Bags had to be left behind. In the controlled chaos, I saw something sparkly on the beach and snatched it. It was a pack of my favorite instant noodles. The Hue was overstuffed with people whose lives were completely in Dad's hands. Everyone kept still, fearing that one small movement could cause a crash. The 40-minute escape was fraught with despair. The wives now realized the dire fate that awaited their husbands. Mom was the only woman who wasn't wailing. Dad spotted the USS Midway and flew closer to the massive gray carrier, majestic against the vast blue ocean. The crewmen below navigated Dad's craft by waving sticks, and he safely landed on a piece of U.S. territory. Crewmen rushed to the Hue as the blades stopped swirling. They counted the number of people disembarking in disbelief and praised Dad's aviation skills. Whatever sense of relief or accomplishment my dad had was short-lived. He asked whether he could refuel and head back to Kansan, but he was told there was no going back. As Dad watched the Americans push Hue's overboard to make room for other landing helicopters, his chest clenched as he thought of loved ones left behind. We were now officially refugees at the full mercy of our U.S. allies. Our luggage was searched for weapons and contraband. The fear was that Viet Cong would hide among the horde of evacuees. We joined several thousand other evacuees in the dining area below deck and ate the undeniably all-American ham sandwiches. Not knowing if soy sauce was available in America, one of our friends shoved several packets into her pockets. After a few hours on the Midway, officers instructed our helicopter group to board a nearby ship. We had to mount makeshift ropes to board the merchant vessel. Dad strapped my baby brother onto his back. He helped get every member of his party ready to climb a fraying rope to the ship. Mom safely reached the other side with my sister and me. She turned around and saw Dad's rope break. Miraculously, he was able to pull himself up while holding on to my baby brother, avoiding the 7-meter plunge into the netting below. The merchant ship was crowded with approximately 10,000 evacuees. We docked for about a week, waiting for more to board. Other ships rescued as many refugees as they could, but they were overwhelmed with more people than they could handle. Dad worried about what nation would accept thousands of refugees from an unpopular war. Food stocks ran low. Each person was rationed a bowl of rice with canned tuna. Our group huddled in one area of the ship. Next to us, a mother was alone with 5 young children. Mom offered 2 bags of instant noodles in her bag. She didn't know the woman was Captain Kiem Do's wife. She had been separated from her husband, a Navy officer who famously organized the successful evacuation of more than 30,000 refugees aboard more than 30 ships. The two women became lifelong friends. I was still weak with the mumps. Mom had a limited supply of medicine and ground the pills using an American quarter. A gaunt woman wailed in agony through the night. One day, after waking from a nap, I saw 2 sailors throw her lifeless body overboard. Years later, in the comfort and safety of America, I asked my parents if this really happened. They said there were many who were seriously ill on the ship, suffering from diarrhea, dehydration, and even dysentery. Those who died were thrown overboard. I shuddered, thinking how it could have been me. But Mom always pointed out how generous people were when they saw me suffering. Many strangers gave me half their rice portions. The extra rice and penicillin saved my life. My parents vowed to teach each other that once our family settled somewhere, they would do all they could to support their community. On that ship, news of Saigon's collapse on April 30th trickled in. Whispers spread from group to group. We learned about the suicides of some generals of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, one of whom was Dad's mentor. As their fates were shared, the women in our party started weeping again. Dad left us to take a walk. His tears could flow more freely among strangers. From refugee camps to New Orleans. Many days later, as we faced starvation, our boat landed by the U.S. Navy base at Subic Bay, Philippines. The Philippine government was initially hesitant to shelter South Vietnamese refugees, but ultimately agreed to provide a haven on Grand Island in the mouth of Subic Bay, on the condition that the transits were brief. We refugees were contained in one area. Upon arrival, all 9 children in our group were famished and dehydrated. Mom opened my pack of favorite instant noodles that I had found on the beach, crushed the contents in a bowl with cold water, and gave each of us a sip. Around us, vendors wandered, trying to take advantage of our desperate plight. Dad's only valuable possession was a watch given to him by President Nguyen Van Tho of the now-defunct Republic of Vietnam. He traded it for scraps of food and 2 cans of Coke. Later, he said the Coke brought color back to my face, and for the first time since our evacuation, he knew I'd survive. That, to him, was priceless. We stayed at the Subic Bay camp for 2 days, huddled together in makeshift lodgings to keep warm during the cold night. Food eventually arrived, and the men of our group routinely waited in line for handouts, sometimes as long as 6 hours. After Subic Bay, we were flown to Guam, a U.S. territory, and processed as political refugees. It was there that Mom felt more sane and settled, but anxiety still plagued her. In moments when she thought about the fate awaiting her endangered family left behind, she'd take out her small bottle of Chanel No. 5. This was the first gift that Dad had brought back for her from his pilot training in the United States. For her, it represented hope that one day we could return to a normal life. In the autumn of 1975, after residing at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida for a few months, we settled in a neighborhood of New Orleans called Woodlawn that primarily housed Vietnamese refugees. Not long after we resettled there, Jim and Betty Adams became our sponsors. Perhaps they chose my parents because they had shared professions as pilot and teacher, respectively. My siblings and I were proud to have 2 American brothers, Jim Jr. and Dave. Betty spent hours each week teaching my mom English. Years later, Mom became one of the first Vietnamese American teachers in Louisiana. The Carters, who owned a horse ranch, also adopted us. Their son had served in Vietnam. When we first arrived, Dad had offers to fly for oil companies, given the boom in the Gulf of Mexico and the need for helicopter pilots to fly between rigs. Mom didn't want to take any more risks and insisted that he find a terrestrial job. He started as a hospital translator and then became an Exxon mechanic. Mom was the produce girl at Schwegman's and used her income to give back to the community. On Sundays, she made huge pots of pho and cha gio, fried spring rolls, and opened up our home to uncles and aunts, whom I would eventually understand to be young refugees without families. Mom's spring rolls would later save us from hostile Cajun neighbors who initially found us threatening as outsiders. They eventually not only left us alone to live our American dream, but also provided support when Mom was suffering from cancer. Reconnecting with family in post-war Vietnam. Mom died 2 weeks after I turned 18. Heartbroken, Dad found it difficult to accept her death, considering all they had overcome together. She had survived bombs and bullets only to lose her life in suburbia. In the wake of that loss, I embarked on a journey to find my extended family. After a trip to Vietnam in 1992, where I reunited with all four of my grandparents, I resolved to find a career that would connect me to them while honoring Mom's legacy of giving back. I spent years working in international development, helping Vietnam integrate into the world economy and improve the quality of life and potential of its people, before pivoting to academia to learn about the region and conflict that had long intrigued me. On April 30th, 2011, exactly 36 years since I left Vietnam, I earned my doctorate in the field of Asian politics. While researching, I found that South Vietnamese stories were underrepresented in the mainstream narrative of the conflict that defined a generation. Having grown up in a community of political refugees, listening to war tales in my youth, and witnessing the U.S.-Vietnam reconciliation process as a development practitioner, I can appreciate multiple viewpoints. Reconciliation, however, cannot be complete without the inclusion and healing of the South Vietnamese, who felt abandoned by their U.S. allies, misunderstood, and unfairly vilified and misrepresented in pop culture and war literature. Younger generations of Vietnamese Americans, like me, unknowingly experienced intergenerational trauma, carrying the scars of our shared and suppressed history. Our worldview is likely shaped by our parents' hardships and lived experiences. As for my father, it wasn't until the fall of Kabul in Afghanistan in 2021 that he was finally ready to talk about Vietnam. The post-traumatic stress disorder that had plagued him suddenly came to the fore, prompting him to contact fellow Da Lat National Military Academy peers, now octogenarians and nonagenarians. He visits Vietnam War memorials to thank all those lives lost and hugs every veteran he sees now. These days, Dad wants Vietnamese people everywhere to succeed and make a positive impact on society. While therapy is still not in his vocabulary, he finds healing in writing, meditating, visiting the local Chao Dai Temple, drinking boba tea with his grandchildren, and cheering for the NBA Dallas Mavericks. As a former war pilot, he's also rooting for Ukrainian pilots as they now bravely defend their homeland. Ngan Nguyen, a social entrepreneur and political scientist, is the global strategic advisor for Asian Heritage at Citi and co-founder owner of IV Sprigrolls. Moving into the money section, the first article is entitled Watch Your Taxes with Roth 401k Contributions. If company matches, you could be on hook. This is written by Medora Lee. If your company's offering you a Roth 401k match, you should contribute enough to trigger that free money and boost your retirement savings. But take note, this financial move could lead to a tax bill. Secure Act 2.0, which passed in December 2022, allowed employers for the first time to match Roth 401k contributions directly into a Roth account. Before the new law, employers had to establish a second traditional 401k for their contributions to retirement funds. There's a wrinkle in the new rules, though. Remember that your Roth 401k contributions are taxed. allowing you, the employee, to withdraw the money during your retirement years without paying taxes. But it's different for your employer. Their contributions to your Roth 401k through matches are pre-tax, just like they would be if your company matched a traditional 401k. That means you're on the hook to pay taxes on your company's Roth contributions the year they're made. The biggest pitfall is remembering to cover the employer contributions, said Mark Stieber, Chief Tax Information Officer at Tax Preparer Jackson Hewitt. If, for example, your employer contributes $500 to your Roth 401k, that's $500 of income you need to pay taxes on, he said. What taxes will you owe? You'll owe federal taxes on the amount your employer contributes each year. You'll receive a 1099-R with a code G in Box 7, said Mark Yeager, Vice President of Tax Operations at tax software company Tax Act. This amount will be included as ordinary income on your tax return. If you live in a state with an income tax, you'll owe tax there too, he added. Do you report a Roth 401k on taxes? Your contribution should appear on your W-2, but since they're post-tax, you don't have to report them on your tax return. But you'll have to report your employer's direct Roth 401k contributions, if any, shown on the 1099-R you should receive. That amount will be taxed. Roth. How can I pay the taxes? You have a few options for paying the taxes, tax experts say. Report the contributions on your tax return as part of your income and pay when you file your taxes. Or, increase your federal withholdings from your W-2 by filing a new W-4 with your employer if you don't want a larger tax bill when you file your taxes. Make estimated tax payments each quarter to cover the additional taxes. If you live in a state with income taxes, you may wish to do the same in that state, Yeager said. What are 2024 contribution limits for a Roth 401k? The maximum amount you can contribute to a Roth 401k for 2024 is $23,000 if you're younger than 50. If you're 50 and older, you can add an extra $7,500 per year in catch-up contributions, bringing your total for the year to $30,500. Employer match contributions don't count toward those personal contribution limits, but there's a limit for combined employee and employer contributions. In 2024, it's either 100% of your salary or $69,000, excluding catch-up contributions, whichever is lower. How were Roth 401k matches handled before Secure Act 2.0? Before Secure Act 2.0, an employee would contribute money to a Roth 401k, but a second traditional 401k was established for the employer contributions. For example, you contribute $2,000 to a Roth 401k with post-tax dollars, but your employer matches that with $1,000 in pre-tax dollars into a traditional 401k. If I wanted to convert that traditional 401k over to Roth 401k, I would pay ordinary taxes, no special capital gains rate, on that $1,000 plus or minus any gains or losses earned through that amount, Yeager said. Now, after Secure Act 2.0, contributions would look like this. You contribute $2,000 to a Roth 401k with post-tax dollars, and your employer matches $1,000 to a Roth 401k. Your employer issues you a 1099-R, and you must pay taxes on that $1,000. How many companies offer Roth 401k matches? More than 90% of retirement plans offer a Roth 401k option, according to brokerage giant Fidelity, but not many offer the match in its latest form so far. 15% have added the optional provision of Secure 2.0 to allow participants to elect Roth treatment of employer contributions, and 25% are actively considering this provision, said plan sponsor Council of America, an industry trade group. Nearly 40% have not and will not implement this provision, and the rest are unsure. Though many plan sponsors like this provision in theory, and the recent guidance has made it more attractive to offer, many don't want the added administrative complexity, especially if they already allow in-plan Roth conversions, the plan sponsor Council of America said. Next in the money section, caregivers need help with stress. Study finds many struggle balance work-life tasks. This is written by Betty Lynn Fisher. There is a picture on this article, and with a caption, caregivers are struggling to balance taking care of a loved one with working and need more support from employers, a new survey finds. And in the picture, there's an older gentleman sitting at a table with a woman that looks like a professional caregiver leaning over, and they're smiling at each other. Family caregivers are struggling to work while juggling caregiving responsibilities, which could threaten a large part of the workforce unless employers are more supportive, a new study reports. ARP and S&P Global surveyed 1,200 self-identified caregivers who work full-time or part-time at large U.S. companies and provide at least 6 hours of care each week to an adult in order to understand caregivers' experiences in the workplace and the significance of employer benefits for balancing work and family care obligations, the organizations said in a press release. An analysis of a new study released Thursday by ARP and S&P Global underscores the importance for employers to implement policies and benefits that are friendly and supportive of adult caregiving to retain this critical segment of employees in the workforce, the two organizations said. The need is critical as the nation's population of adults ages 65 and older is projected to surpass the population of children by 2030, the organization said. What is a family caregiver? ARP research has found that of the more than 48 million family caregivers nationwide, 61% are working while juggling caregiving responsibilities, including assisting with daily living activities, medical or nursing tasks, coordinating services, transportation, shopping, and advocating for their loved ones. Most family caregivers provide at least 20 hours of care each week, equal to an unpaid part-time job, according to ARP. These caregivers are providing more than $600 billion in unpaid care for their loved ones, ARP has said. As Americans grow older, more families have more members with caregiving needs, like young children and their parents, while also holding down a job or career, Susan Reinhart, ARP Senior Vice President and Director of the Public Policy Institute, said in a statement about the report, which was provided exclusively to USA Today ahead of a media briefing Thursday. The majority of family caregivers juggle their responsibilities for loved ones every hour of every day, Reinhart said. As a result, working family caregivers are overwhelmed by the sheer volume of daily tasks. At ARP, we're engaging the private sector to be sure companies big and small are thinking through possible solutions to better support their employees who are family caregivers. Family caregivers need and deserve greater support from their own employers, Reinhart also said in a press release, As our population ages, it's critical that employers support family caregivers in the workforce with the policies such as paid leave that can ease their everyday burdens. What did the study find? An analysis of the study, Working While Caregiving, It's Complicated, conducted in 2023 by ARP and S&P Global, shows that the unpredictable nature of caregiving for an adult is among the biggest stressors that caregivers face, the organization said. Here are some highlights. 67% of family caregivers have difficulty balancing their jobs with caregiving duties. 27% of working caregivers have shifted from full-time to part-time work or have reduced hours, while 16% have turned down a promotion. 16% have stopped working entirely for a period of time, and 13% have changed employers to meet caregiving responsibilities. 80% of respondents agree that companies were more understanding of childcare issues than adult caregiving responsibilities. Study authors said that was particularly the case among caregivers who have an under 18 child in the home and therefore have recent experience in both situations. Caregivers without children reported less satisfaction with company support than caregivers with children, 69% versus 89% respectively. Remote workers were more likely to feel penalized or discriminated against at work because of caregiving responsibilities compared to in-office or hybrid workers, 49% versus combined average of 29%. Study authors said this may reflect employer challenges in assessing and engaging with remote employees' work-life needs. Among working caregivers providing more than 21 hours of care a week, 37% are experiencing significantly increased difficulty due to inflation. For those providing fewer than 10 hours of care, 25% say inflation has made providing care significantly more difficult. Despite the progress observed since 2020, the latest data shows the majority of employees with adult caregiving responsibilities continue to face barriers at balancing work and caregiving obligations and need greater support from employers through enhanced benefits and policies to stay engaged in the workforce, said Alexandra Dimitrijevic, co-chair of S&P Global Research Council, in the press release. Employers can help by paying forward-looking attention to employee needs and the demographics shift of the workforce in the coming years. Some employers are making progress. Since the last joint report by ARP and S&P Global in 2020, employers, having become attuned to the needs of working parents over the past decade, and especially during the pandemic, are now moving from awareness to action in providing support for employees with adult caregiving responsibilities, the organizations said. According to the new report, access to a flexible work schedule at the time of caregiving increased from 32% in 2020 to 45% in 2023. The availability of caregiving policies or benefits also increased in every category except unpaid leave. However, the organizations said employers can provide more support. The report identifies industry best practices that companies can take to support caregivers, including offer and support flexible schedules and flexible work locations, hybrid remote. Offer employer-supported access to support groups, career coaching, and financial advising resources. Offer paid leave specifically for caregivers and/or flexible leave that can be used to help with caregiver duties. host free sessions to highlight how caregiving employees can optimize employer benefits and policies as a way to address the lack of awareness in using benefits. Ask senior leaders to share their stories of how they have used the caregiver supportive benefits and policies, signaling to both people managers and their teams that they are encouraged to use them. Train people managers on caregiver-inclusive managerial practices. Ensure managers are aware of caregiver supportive benefits and policies and message their direct reports that it is safe to use them all without incurring career risk. Start or support an employee resource group for parents and caregivers or create a caregiving initiative across all ERGs. Federal administration offering some help. During a media briefing about the study on Thursday, Xavier Becerra, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, said when it comes to caregiving, more Americans are realizing how much pressure is put on the shoulders of a few caring for their older relatives. Family caregivers are providing more support and have an even larger time getting the type of rest that they need as they care for their loved ones. Becerra said, it's becoming a real crisis for families in America. Becerra said more families are having trouble finding the help they need or can't afford to pay for that care or get care at a facility and have to take care of that burden themselves. Becerra said, noted, the first ever national strategy to support family caregivers, which we have been working across the board to implement. At the end of April, we took action to both improve the quality of care and strengthen support for caregivers, including those who make caregiving a profession and those who are doing the unpaid work of care at home as they support their loved one. That includes final rules to nursing home staffing, standards and rules to improve access to care in Medicaid, and Children's Health Insurance Program to home care services, he said. It also includes an executive order last April signed by President Joe Biden, which included 50 directives to federal agencies to increase access to affordable, high-quality care and provide support to rising child care and family caregiving costs. It's going to take more than an administration, Becerra said. It'll take all of us, the voices of those who receive care, and certainly the experience of caregivers. Congressional bill could help caregivers. A bill reintroduced in January by a bipartisan group of U.S. senators and members of the U.S. House of Representatives could provide help in the form of a federal tax credit for eligible working family caregivers. ARP has been working with legislators for 8 years on previous versions of the bill, but senior ARP leaders in January told USA Today that they believe the time is finally right for it to become law and bring relief to many caregivers, including members of Congress. The bill has made no progress in Congress, but it does have more congressional co-sponsors. In January, 6 senators and 2 representatives introduced the bill. It now has 33 additional sponsors in the House for a total of 39 in both chambers. The Credit for Caring Act, if passed, would provide financial support for individual caregivers by providing up to a $5,000 non-refundable federal tax credit for eligible working family caregivers. That would cover 30% of qualified expenses they incurred above $2,000. ARP representatives had no new comment regarding the status of the bill, but Reinhart, during the media briefing, said the act could help caregivers. Next in the money section, New Hampshire Bank redefines long-term investing. Walden Mutual offering customers a 100-year CD. This is written by Medora Lee. Savers may want to lock in high interest rates for the long haul before they likely head lower later this year. But is 100 years too long? Concord, New Hampshire-based Walden Mutual Bank is finding out. The financial institution is offering a 100-year local impact certificate of deposit, paying a fixed 4.75% annual interest rate. The CD is open to anyone with $1,000 and up to $150,000 to invest and is Federal Deposit Insurance Corp insured up to $250,000. The CD allows people to invest alongside Walden to support local agriculture, specifically lending to food and agriculture businesses in New England and New York, the bank said. A 5-year CD is common, a 10-year CD is a rarity, and a 100-year CD is one of a kind, said Mary Grace Roski, spokeswoman at CD rates comparison site cdvalet.com. Walden Mutual has created a unique opportunity for people who want to align their values, environmental responsibility in this case, and their savings, and it's a creative spin on socially responsible investing. What is the 100-year CD? Here are the details. Minimum investment of $1,000 up to $150,000 per individual or organization. Fixed 4.75% APY for the 100-year life of the CD. FDIC insurance up to $250,000. A completed beneficiary form is mandatory at account opening. You may withdraw your entire deposit at any time by request, subject to a penalty of 10 years interest. If you withdraw the CD before 10 years, the penalty will reduce the principal value of the CD. Interest paid can be withdrawn penalty-free at any time, automatically or by request. In about 15 years, more than half of your deposit will be interest, which is withdrawable on demand and penalty-free. For example, if you purchased a CD for $1,000 and withdrew it after 20 years, you would receive $1,942 or an effective interest rate of 3.32%. Partial withdrawal of principal is not permitted. It isn't callable by the bank, meaning only the holder can redeem the bond early. What is Walden Mutual Bank? Walden is a mutual savings bank and a certified B Corporation or a for-profit corporation certified with a social impact. Walden's focused on serving farms, food businesses, sustainability-related businesses, and nonprofit organizations, according to cdvalet.com. It's a mutual bank, meaning it has no shareholders and it's owned by its depositors, Walden said. Walden was founded in 2022 as an online bank for everyone who eats, makes, grows, cooks, loves local food, its 2022 annual report said. Chief Executive Charlie Cummings combines a business degree with an agricultural background, having started a meat community-supported agriculture that allows consumers to buy shares of a farm's harvest in advance. Why a 100-year CD? Walden said a 100-year CD allows it to offer local agricultural businesses longer-term loans. For example, a low-margin farm may not be able to support the payments on a 10-year mortgage for farmland, but if those terms are extended to 30 years, the payment is manageable, Walden said. In order to support those longer-term goals or longer-term loans, we need longer-term deposits to ensure we can properly manage our balance sheet. Is the 100-year CD a good investment? Walton said the CD makes for a good addition to a donor-advised fund, part of a charitable giving strategy, or a trust intended to benefit a future generation. But it is also an attractive fixed-income alternative for an individual or organization, even if not held to maturity. But if you're looking solely to maximize returns, some advisors say look elsewhere. Here's why. Interest rates may rise above the 100-year CD's fixed 4.75% rate, and you'll lose out, Roske said. The broad S&P 500 stock index has returned 8 to 10% annually, on average, for the last century. Significant early withdrawal penalty of 10 years of interest, which could include loss of principal of less than 10 years. Other CDs lose interest only, said Steve Azzouri, founder of Azzouri Financial. Walden Mutual has a short operating history, Azzouri said. The CDs covered by the FDIC, but you could get a big hassle if Walden closed up. Potential tax headaches of reporting CD interest for a century. Azzouri said, beneficiaries must pay tax yearly on their portion of the interest after the original owner passes, and if you have multiple beneficiaries, what if one wants to cash it out and another doesn't? A charity wouldn't have to worry about that, though. Who's the right investor for a Century CD? If it's a conservative strategy to incorporate into a charitable giving plan or a trust intended to benefit a future generation. I'm going to repeat that sentence. It is a conservative strategy to incorporate into a charitable giving plan or a trust intended to benefit a future generation, Roske said. Of course, there are more profitable ways to invest, but the 100-year CD captures the think globally, act locally mindset of a growing number of people, end quote. The next article in the money section is entitled, Book Now If You Want to See Europe This Summer. Americans are heading to Europe for vacation as much as ever these days. Book Now If You Want to See Europe is in the Cruising Altitude portion of Money and written by Zach Wichter. I've never seen a year like this. We're at the point where there's no more availability. Book as quickly as possible. Brigitte Armand, president of Eurobound, a tour organizer that specializes in European packages. Americans are heading to Europe for vacation as much as ever these days, and that means the typical tourist spots like Venice, Paris, and London are sure to be crowded this year. But because this is cruising altitude, we'll look at the aviation angle first. First and foremost, if you're really determined to go to Europe this summer and haven't booked yet, stop reading now and get on it. I've never seen a year like this. We're at the point where there's no more availability. Brigitte Armand, president of Eurobound, a tour organizer that specializes in European packages, told me, book as quickly as possible. How to get around? According to Armand, trains are generally a great way to get from place to place within Europe, but for farther-flung stops, the continent's network of low-cost airlines offers travelers a reliable alternative. Don't think of one airline as being your network and entry point within Europe. Laura Lindsay, public relations director at online booking platform Skyscanner, told me. She said, if you're flying to Europe from the U.S., you may well rely on a large network carrier like British Airways, KLM, or Lufthansa to get across the Atlantic and then book your intra-European flight separately. You're suddenly opening up Europe in a different way if you search for different airports and multiple airlines, Lindsay said. It's pretty straightforward to get around, so don't feel put off by jumping through a few different countries or trying a few different destinations. Tips for European airlines. According to Lindsay, European low-cost carriers such as Ryanair, EasyJet, and Wizz Air often have stricter baggage policies similar to American ULCC, Spirit, and Frontier. The top tip would be always make sure you understand the luggage allowance that is part of your ticket, she said. More often than not, don't book the basic fare without checking. It's also a good idea to be flexible with your airports and dates of travel if you want to get the best deals on those shorter flights. You'll get a number of places that have more than one airport, Lindsay said, noting that Skyscanner has a tool that allows travelers to search for flights to or from nearby airports when choosing a destination. Just getting a map out and actually looking at where exactly you want to travel and where the nearby airports are. Armand added that if you take the train instead, you may need to secure a reservation in advance, particularly if for some of the more tourist-heavy routes like panoramic trains in Switzerland. Where to go? If you really want to summer like a European, you should consider places a little more off the radar for most Americans. Albania is somewhere that broke through a couple of years ago as somewhere that people recognized as offering a huge value for money, Lindsay said. Sarajevo is reporting its busiest April on record for travelers. Armand said it can also be a good idea to try different parts of countries that are already popular if you want a more authentic, less crowded experience. We recently arranged a whole trip for some clients in the Abruzzo region of Italy, she said. The Abruzzo region, it's on the Adriatic. People don't know this region, and I think this is the first time ever we put together a package to get to that region. Data from Skyscanner shows that some destinations in Europe are picking up in popularity with travelers on the continent. Here are some trends bubbling up year over year from 23 to 24. Ljubljana, Slovenia saw a 188% increase in searches from Spanish travelers. Tromsø, Norway saw a 130% increase in interest from Italian holidaymakers. Düsseldorf, Germany had a 122% spike in interest from Brits. According to Armand, the best last-minute availability seems to be in Eastern Europe, like Bulgaria and Poland. There are some good deals there, perhaps. Even the Czech Republic, I'm finding some decent space, she said. So go on, get packing. The next article in Money is Ask Human Resources. You can look for a job without burning bridges. This is written by Johnny C. Taylor. Johnny C. Taylor Jr. tackles your human resources questions as part of a series for USA Today. Taylor is president and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management, the world's largest HR professional society, and author of Reset, A Leader's Guide to Work in an Age of Upheaval. Question. I've developed close ties with our clients in 6 years as a consultant. One recently floated the idea of bringing me on as a direct employee. Though interested, I'm concerned about navigating my candidacy process and how it might impact my relationship with my current company and our client. What is the best way to explore this opportunity without damaging my professional relationships? From Vince. Answer. Navigating potential career transitions, especially when they involve valued clients, requires careful consideration and communication to ensure that professional relationships remain intact. Here's how you can explore this opportunity without jeopardizing these important connections. Number 1. Check agreements. Begin by reviewing any non-compete or non-solicitation agreements you have with your current employer. These deals may restrict your ability to work directly for clients or competitors for a certain period. If there are no such restrictions, you can proceed with exploring the opportunity. Number two, confidential conversations. Keep your discussions about the potential transition confidential with your client and current employer. Request the same level of discretion from your client to avoid any premature disruptions or misunderstandings. Candid discussion is number three. If you accept the new opportunity, have an open and honest conversation with your current employer. Inform your manager of your decision, discuss your transition plan, and express your gratitude for the opportunities you've had with the company. Number four, smooth transition. Plan how to transition your responsibilities to ensure a seamless handoff. Connect your clients with the appropriate contacts at your current company to maintain continuity in their service. Number five, remaining with current employer. If you choose to stay with your current employer, communicate openly with your client about your decision. Express appreciation for their interest and reaffirm your commitment to continuing your positive working relationship, even if it remains an indirect one. Throughout this process, prioritize maintaining professionalism and fostering positive relationships with your current employer and client. Embrace the opportunity to deepen your connections and ensure that your decisions contribute positively to your future career endeavors. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Nancy Frank reading from USA Today, second hour. That's the opinion and money sections. Have a good week.